I get started. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the last Lowy Institute event for the year. I appreciate you all taking a break from your Christmas parties to come, and we certainly aren't talking about something warm and fuzzy as we're heading into the holidays. I'm Natasha Kassam. I'm a research fellow here at the Lowy Institute, and I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to elders, both past and present. So the threat of the armed conflict is looming more seriously than ever. Here in our region, we have long-standing hostility between China and Taiwan, North and South Korea, India and Pakistan, and the various territorial disputes over the East and South China Seas. So today we're going to discuss what are the factors that influence states' decisions to talk to their opponents during war, and when might their position on wartime diplomacy change? And how do we get from fighting to also talking? And then really, it'd be really interesting for us if we have time to talk about how we might use these lessons going forward and to avoid any of those tensions in our region from spilling into war. I'm very pleased to welcome today Professor Arianna Skylar-Mastro. She is an assistant professor of security studies at the Edmund Welsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and an officer in the United States Air Force Reserve. She's literally written a book on what brings states to the table during wartime, and it's called The Costs of Conversation. And there are many more impressive titles, but we're very pleased to have her here today. And then to provide us with an Australian perspective and that of a distinguished practitioner, we have Professor James Goldrick, who joined the Royal Australian Navy in 1974 and retired in 2012 as a two-star Rear Admiral. He commanded the HMAS ships Cessnock and Sydney, the multinational maritime interception force in the Persian Gulf, and the Australian Defence Force Academy. He's led Australia's Border Protection Command and later commanded the Australian Defence College. He's now an adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales and a professorial fellow of the Australian National Centre for Ocean Resources and Security. Again, many more titles, but we're very pleased to have them both here today, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So, Arianna, we might start with you. You've looked at various diplomatic postures by China and India and North Vietnam during the Korean War, the Sino-Indian War, and the Vietnam War. So what did you find was necessary for states to come to the table in those conflicts? What's the thesis?
So the main thesis, I always say in political science, the best arguments are one that are very commonsensical, though it takes us years and years to actually get to them. Much archival work in many different countries around the world. The basic idea is that states are concerned that a willingness to talk is going to demonstrate weakness to their adversary. And this weakness can be weak resolve, weak capabilities, or even more limited aims than a country is currently expressing. And instead of actually encouraging diplomacy, this might actually encourage their adversary to fight harder or longer at higher levels of conflict. So if you can imagine, if there's two states and they're fighting, and then one side all of a sudden says, I want to talk, maybe the state that didn't first make that proposition is thinking, wow, this war must be going really well for me. It must be doing a really good job. Pressure is working. I should put more pressure on my opponent. So the book first lays out this sort of puzzle, because at least a lot of scholars focus on how to prevent wars. But as was mentioned, there are a lot of areas of tension. We know wars happen, so most of my research focuses on how to ensure any conflicts are as limited in duration and violence as possible once they break out. And one of the obstacles to that is this reluctance of states to get to the negotiating table, because nowadays we have a large majority of our conflicts end by negotiated settlement. So the first step is to get them to the table. And if states are concerned that actually willingness to talk risks more conflict versus brings on peace, then this, I argue, is an additional obstacle that we have to have better strategies to deal with.
And what do you think, James, having commanded ships in the Navy and dealt with many conflicts over your career, does this ring true to you, this level of weakness being an obstacle?
I think Arianna's thesis rings true, because one's talking, as I understand it, you know, Arianna's very much talking about the conflict is on, and there's this concern that if you do announce a willingness to talk, then the other side reads the wrong things from it. And it does ring true. And I think if you actually look at the examples given in the book with China and India, and I found that the crisis in the early 60s particularly compelling, with China being willing to negotiate because China actually knew it had achieved what it wanted, and India not being able to negotiate because it felt there was this feeling that it would simply indicate weakness and China would move even further into potential areas of Indian vulnerability. But I think it's important to say that doesn't, as I understand it, and again, I think it rings true, that doesn't mean you're not talking before and you're not trying to raise understanding beforehand of what the potential issues are.
So the dynamic, that's absolutely right. So the dynamic only works because when you're in a wartime environment, the other side is constantly coercing you, right? So you are under duress, you are under that pressure. So in peacetime, these dynamics, though they might exist in certain scenarios, like if a country is experiencing severe economic sanctions, so they feel like there is a coercion plan at place, they're a lot less severe. They're the most severe when, you know, a state simultaneously is using military force against you and then saying you should come to the negotiating table. Because what they're trying to do is a compelling strategy, getting you to do something you don't want to do. And we know that in general, those are difficult because then states are concerned about the reputation and the costs moving forward.
And so then if there are costs associated with coming to the table in that sense, what role do you think mediators, for example, can play?
Well, so the first thing is, you know, for better or for worse, what that means is that a state is going to be unwilling to talk unless they've demonstrated enough strength in other areas. So this is kind of the first step because they want to counteract any signal of weakness. So some states, like the example of China in 62 or the United States, it has in some cases a lot more military power than whoever it's fighting. You'll see very powerful states kind of escalating, maybe I'll bomb more targets or do this more, right, to show that I'm not coming to the table out of weakness. But most states don't have such military capability. So the way that they demonstrate strength is by continuing to fight for long periods of time. So they want to demonstrate strength. And then the second thing is, you know, you're less concerned about looking weak if your opponent doesn't have the ability to escalate, if they're constrained somehow. Right, because what you're really concerned, the cost only comes into play based on the other side's response. So mediators, what they can do is they can provide more guarantees, first, that the other side is not going to escalate in response, or if the mediators are in a weaker military position than whoever is fighting, they can provide deniability. So if they offer some sort of positive inducement to a state to talk, then that state can say, I'm agreeing to diplomacy not because I'm weak, not because I'm losing this war, but because of this external benefit that I'm getting. So it gives them some deniability. So in that way, I see mediation differently than the standard literature that looks at it mainly as information transition, helping states communicate. And I see it more as a kind of the only way you can really provide off-ramps is through third parties.
Right, and I'll be interested to ask you later about who might be able to provide some of those off-ramps in our current kind of conflict scenarios. But James, Arianna mentioned that this kind of level of capability makes a really significant impact on the ability of states to negotiate. And I'm wondering, you know, she mentioned China. Obviously, we've seen we've obviously seen quite significant changes in China's capability since the 60s and the Sino-Indian War to today. How are you seeing that play out?
I think we're seeing it play out in an increased confidence in China to use coercion. What I'd say is it's generally graduated use. It's quite striking the extent to which China has not used military force directly, but has used other state-based elements with the military force behind it. So it has been quite nuanced. But what is striking, I think, is an increasing confidence in China and in China's military in their capability and their ability to project power. And of course, that's particularly clear in relation to Taiwan. There does seem to be an increasing confidence that the PLA feels that it is now, you know, it is approaching very closely an ability to be able to achieve military success. The danger is an underestimation of the costs of using that capability, both the direct costs, let's say, to the PLA, and also the costs to China and everybody else. But that, I think, is what we're seeing happen, even though the South China Sea is the clear case, there have been use of other elements of state power to coerce rather than directly the Navy or the military.
And Arianna, you mentioned to me earlier that we need to start thinking about kind of different conceptions of power and not just being militarily based. So do you see that playing out in kind of China's foreign policy and those different instruments?
Yeah, so I wrote an article a little less than a year ago in Foreign Affairs about how China thinks about and builds power. And I find that my arguments are a lot less controversial here in Australia than they are in the United States, because surprise, surprise, it seems like, you know, in the United States, there's this view that China wants exactly what we have. So we're always looking for indicators that China is copying what we do. And this is why I think it took a long time for the United States to wake up to the challenge of China, because, you know, they have BRI, they don't have a global military presence in which foreign military intervention is a key tool of their foreign policy. But in the United States, I have these constant debates with people that are like, that's coming. That's what China wants. And my view as a Mandarin speaker myself, reading all the writings and talking to people in China, it's not that they don't want that because they're not ambitious. They don't want that because the nature of the international system has changed such that that is no longer an efficient way of building and exercising influence. They see it as extremely costly. So just like the United States didn't build colonies after World War II because Great Britain had a colonial empire, I think it's wrong for us to look at what China's doing and say they're obviously going to do exactly what we do. So they're definitely combining political and economic power to achieve a certain level of control that you used to only be able to gain through military means. And then, very smartly, trying to avoid direct military conflict with the United States, knowing that in most scenarios, at least for now, though that's shifting, the United States would prevail. So they use kind of more entrepreneurial ways, like gray zone tactics, things that make it hard for us to respond. So in many ways, I think what's important is to say, you know, what is China trying to achieve? How are they trying to achieve it? And then now the United States has woken up to that, but our response is, let's try to do exactly what China's doing, right? They have BRI, so we have the Build Act. But again, if you think about it in a business sense, if you have a competitor, you don't want to try to compete with them by producing exactly the same product they produce if you make it worse, right? Like every country has comparative advantages too, and the U.S. comparative advantage is not in infrastructure building, right? So is this really where we want to be competing with China? We should be shifting the competition elsewhere. And I do think, even though I focus on military issues, that being the security partner of choice, even if we do achieve that in the region, is no longer sufficient to maintain the U.S. position here.
Okay, but then if we are going to compete or use our comparative advantages, where should the United States be focusing?
So I think a lot of it has to do with combining the economic with the military and the political and looking specifically at the domestic politics of the countries involved. So one of my biggest frustrations with my job at the Pentagon, being a China specialist, is as a China specialist, I get asked all sorts of things about the region. Like, if the United States wants to have more influence in country X, you know, what should we do? And I always say, well, I'm not an expert on that country. I'm an expert on China. But what we look at is just what China is doing, what the United States is doing. And at least in the U.S., there's a very low-level knowledge of the specifics of the domestic political environment of most countries in the region. So I always, this is kind of a cop-out, but I need a team. Like, I can't tell you. What I need is, just like when I do war planning, I need operators with me so I can say, I want to have this strategic effect. I know China and I know I want to have this effect. Do we have capabilities to do that? I need economists. I need sociologists. I need area experts. So I can say, okay, I know the United States wants to have this effect. I know this is what China's doing. If we did this, would it have that effect on this country? And as an expert on China, I'm an expert enough to know that what I know about China doesn't apply to all the other countries in the region. And so I definitely need more of that expertise. And while you have a lot of that expertise in Australia, especially about Southeast Asia, we don't have that in the United States for a wide variety of reasons. So I think that's very problematic.
And so when you are trying to achieve these strategic outcomes, for example, Australia or the United States doing freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea, are we achieving the outcomes we'd like to achieve in terms of strategy in China?
I'm very cautious about the term freedom of navigation. It encompasses so many things. What I think is implicit for Australia in what Oriana is saying is that same need for a wide approach to what should Australia be doing in the region. Now, from a naval point of view, part of that is, in my view, very strongly, in the South China Sea, we should be exercising freedom of maritime operations. We have been, as I continue to remind the Chinese, there for more than 100 years, which may not be long by Chinese standards, but it is a long time, and when we were first doing it, we were chasing Americans.
Longer than that.
Yes. But the point is that that's just one part of it. Why should we be there? Because actually we can be there, as we've been trying to do for over a century, either develop or contribute to the security of the region. But we should be doing other things as well, and it's actually working with other governments, increasing our economic involvement, and also, I think, being seen to operate in a way that it's not all about China, it's actually about achieving a worthwhile future in the Australian interest, but that's shared with other people.
And what are Australia's interests in the South China Sea?
I think Australia's interests in the South China Sea are fundamentally that it does not become a closed sea, that China does not, how shall I put it, move the nine-dash line from ambiguity to certainty, that China does not try to exclude other people from the South China Sea. It must remain a shared sea, an open space, and there are a lot of other countries border onto that sea and have shared interests. So in the clear Australian interest is for it to remain a shared sea.
My current book project looks at the South China Sea, and I just spent some time in China talking to their military about this issue. Because while it's a very important issue here, and we talk a lot about it, the scholarly community in the United States, actually, the political community does not care about the South China Sea. So I've been spending a lot of time trying to build this argument of why it's important. But one thing about the freedom of navigation operations, which are problematic, is they demonstrate the United States has the freedom to navigate. But they don't demonstrate that anyone else does, right? And I don't know the specifics of how Australia is doing it either, but it's not like the United States is ensuring that vessels from the Philippines can navigate freely, or Malaysia or Indonesia. So China continues to undermine the norm by being able to harass everyone else. And maybe, yes, they, to a degree, leave the United States alone, Australia alone, or France or the UK when they sail on through. But they are effectively coercing everyone else in the region. And while many countries, and we would say most countries, agree with the US view and the Australian view that these should be open waters, there are still, I think, 30 significant countries, including India, that have different interpretations of maritime law that include the ability to regulate military activities within a country's exclusive economic zone, which is not the US or Australia's position. So in addition to showing through our operations that we have a right to be there, we also have to support other countries' ability to be there. And we also need to be much more proactive about legal and diplomatic efforts. You know, because China, at least in the United States, we always say that, like, China's obviously wrong and everyone knows it. And they feel so isolated and they feel so ashamed for all the things that they do. But then you go to Beijing and they don't feel isolated at all, because in the end it's, you know, Australia and the United States that's chastising Beijing and everyone else is kind of keeping their mouth shut. So I think we need to do a better job on the diplomatic side of getting shared understandings of what maritime rights are in those waters. We don't have to say who owns what, but just, you know, which features get what rights. And then actually be proactive at making Beijing realize that they're the only ones that are kind of pushing this higher level of control. And then maybe the military measures combined with that would be more effective.
So, and I'm not sure that the PLA are entirely leaving Australian and American vessels alone. I think we're seeing much more regular reporting of naval encounters.
And let's put that into context. The Chinese are at sea. They're at sea in a big way. There will be naval encounters. And they will put tails on Chinese ships, just as we would put a tail on a Chinese ship if it were operating close in Australian waters. We'd keep an eye on them. That is how it works at sea. That is not about a conflict as such. It's not a. It isn't likely to create incidents. And there have been plenty of examples of that over 100 years. The Chinese have sent intelligence gatherers to the last two Talisman Sabre exercises. That's entirely within their rights. They do breach their own supposed rules about operations in exclusive economic zones by doing so, but in fact, we we allow them that right and recognise that. So that is part of China is going to see in a big way. There will be encounters. We have a code for unplanned encounters at sea. That adjoins prudence, which I think translates very clearly into Mandarin. And that's the most important word in that. You're prudent when you're operating with any other foreign ships. So I don't see that as being a particular problem.
So if that's not a particular problem, but there's continued concern about escalation in the South China Sea, what do you think about that? How do we avoid that?
Well, that's the danger. It is avoided from our side by the fact that we continue to operate there. We do so prudently. We don't step back. We do it as much as possible and as often as we can with littoral powers. So, for example, that Australia continues to be part of the five-power defence arrangements and continues to conduct exercises with Singapore and Malaysia, the United Kingdom and New Zealand under the FPDA, that we seek opportunities to cooperate with the Philippines and Vietnam and Brunei. And if China wishes to have an exercise, you know, I think that will be terrific. China is a South China Sea power. But we have to keep doing it. And if you step back, then that just reduces your freedom of manoeuvre anyway. But you have to do it prudently.
Just not to disagree, but a slight change of focus. I think our focus on avoiding conflict is incorrect. It's easy to avoid war if you give the other side everything that they want. And that's China's strategy right now, is that they create risk in the South China Sea and in other areas such that the options for the United States and Australia are, do I back down? Or do I accept this risk? And because we're always trying to avoid conflict, at least in the United States for the past, 10 years since the impeccable incident of 2009 that the South China Sea has become an issue, we back down. And that's how we've gotten to this situation in which the deterrent has been eroded, China's being more aggressive against its neighbors because they know introduce a little risk of conflict and we're out. Right. So I would say one of the things, of course, continue to work with allies and partners in the region, but also to be more proactive about not only saying China, we're going to operate here, but think about new policies to stop China from doing what they're doing. So, for example, should the United States think about including exclusive economic zones as part of treaty obligations, right? It's not technically territory, so it's kind of a gray zone of whether or not the United States is required to defend our allies' access to their EEZs. Should we consider like a kind of an anti-piracy type of framework in which there are areas where countries are being denied access that the United States Navy will protect their access, right? These would be very provocative things for China. But at least in my view, in talking to the Chinese military about it, they don't like that I come to this conclusion. But the conclusion I've come to is that they're not ready right now to project power significantly in the vast area that's the South China Sea, right? That's half the size of the continental United States. So if we push back on China now, then we might be able to actually establish some rules of engagement that suit us all. If we wait another 5 years where China feels like it could prevail militarily, then if we push back, they're probably going to escalate. So we have a very small window of opportunity to be able to shape what's actually happening. And if our approach is always, as long as we avoid conflict, then that's good. We're not going to get to where we need to go.
Some of this risk calculus, I think, is in part the PLA is not able to project power sufficiently in the South China Sea because they're very much focused on Taiwan. They've got 1,500 missiles facing Taiwan on any given day. So does that mean that there might be a window of opportunity to set some rules in the South China Sea? But what about our tolerance for conflict or risk of conflict in Taiwan?
So I would say that those are actually two separate issues. I wouldn't see that they're... It's just that China has the advantage, and I'm sure you can talk to this in more detail, but China has the advantage because they're projecting power from their coast, right? And their advantages get smaller and smaller the farther you move out. So the South China Sea is just really far, right? And that's the issue. Now they have a couple island military outposts that they can help them maintain persistent and routine operations, but it's harder because of distances. So they become more reliant on certain things, like the United States is reliant when we project power. In the Taiwan contingency, that's what, 220 nautical miles or something from China's coast. So they, you know, yes, they're projecting power, but they're not really, in that it's so close, they can still rely very heavily on land-based systems to achieve their outcomes. So I think on one part, of course, if the Taiwan issue was resolved and they have more resources to focus on the South China Sea, but it doesn't necessarily mean that then, like, yes, they can project power. They've got a redundant, you know, space-based ISR, you know, and they have the ability to conduct joint operations as necessary, and they can control and monitor all areas of the South China Sea. I mean, the biggest issue right now for control is just awareness of what goes on there, and they're trying to put the assets in place to be able to know what goes on there, but they currently don't have that degree of knowledge to be able to actually control those waters. So I would see those as two very problematic issues, but actually somewhat separate issues when it comes to the military capability side.
And then, I mean, you said that one of the problems is we have this very low level of tolerance for conflict. Do you see with kind of this development of competition and China being seen as a peer competitor of the United States, is that risk appetite shifting?
Depends who you ask. I mean, I think the Department of Defense thinks, like, you know, we're ready to go tomorrow, right? Like, the Department of Defense in the United States has focused on China as the pacing threat for decades, right? President Trump's national security strategy just said it, but we've been doing it for a very long time. The problem, and going back to one of the things with the book that I spent a lot of time doing, is advising the military on certain types of military plans that, one, a president would actually agree to, and two, there's a lot of their views on kind of what would get China to escalate or de-escalate, or what would get them to give in, not give in, that I just don't think are based a lot in reality. So one of the things I mentioned in the book is that the United States has a history, and unfortunately so does China, of believing that rapid escalation gets the other side to talk to you. Like, that's always the U.S. response. Like, I want the other side to talk to me. I'm going to hurt them more, and then they'll come talk to me. Historically, it has never worked for either side. Yet, for both China and the United States, I've read a lot of Chinese military training manuals and doctrines, same in the United States. It is a part of our military culture to continue to teach our military forces that this is an effective way of getting the other side to the negotiating table. So one of the things I mentioned, which is not very popular among military leadership in the U.S., is, you know, if you, short of being able to completely destroy the other side's ability to fight, which the United States couldn't even accomplish against North Vietnam in the Vietnam War, escalating reduces the likelihood of talks. And so if you want, if we're in a certain stage of conflict with China and you want China to come to the table, the answer is not hit more, you know, blow up more stuff. Right? The answer is looking for those positive inducements from outside parties, showing China that somehow we are constrained in terms of, you know, escalation, so that we really would be engaging in diplomacy in good faith.
And what do you think, James? Is, I think in Ariana's book, she says strong countries tend to rely on escalation to bring people to the table. As a kind of middle power in Australia, what would be our approach to those kinds of issues?
I think Ariana's analysis is correct. I mean, a middle power always has a problem in that you can't think quite in that way because you haven't got the resources to escalate to a degree that you're likely to create anything that's existential or semi-existential. But I think one can be encouraging powers like the United States to think the situation through. And I'm not talking about being a mediator, because I think a mediator is inherently more neutral. You know, it's a power that isn't as directly involved. And the reality is, in a lot of the contingencies in Asia, we're going to be directly involved. Even if we're not militarily committed, we're so closely involved that we have skin in the game. I think another point that, and I was talking about it with Ariana before, I was quite struck by, was her use of the word limited war. And I think that there needs to be some clearer and newer thinking, which is somewhat removed from the old Cold War thinking, which was very much based on nuclear exchanges and in a context of existential nuclear war. Now, I'm not to say that things couldn't go horribly wrong and that would not be a nuclear war. But I think most of the potential confrontations between the United States and China are not existential for the United States. So that creates a different agenda. And I think we need to get better at thinking about, okay, how do you manage to avoid limited war? And if you get into a limited war, how do you get out of it? And what I would say is you've got to be really careful to understand limited war doesn't mean it's nice. It can be horrible and incredibly destructive. But nevertheless, it is limited war. This is not necessarily existential. So how do you deal with that?
I think, you know, there is this Cold War thinking, and there was a Washington Post article that covered a panel I was on. There was, like, one of these very prestigious groupings that then, like, invited a few of the younger generation, had, like, a younger generation panel, and then they were, like, all shocked and upset by everything that we said about China. But one of the things I would say as a generalization, the older generation was like, nuclear weapons will deter all of this. We didn't fight the Soviet Union. We won't fight China. And in my view, I mean, first of all, we don't have a mutually assured destructive relationship with China. China, it's debatable whether or not they have a secure second strike, let alone can they really destroy the United States. They just don't have enough warheads. They have, I think, very reasonably decided on a minimum assured deterrent. But the second thing I see, you know, whether it is true or not, both militaries think they can very much fight conventional conflicts against each other without escalation to nuclear war. So I think that is definitely much more of a possibility. One of the big issues where I see some misunderstanding when it comes to ending those wars that I talk about in the book has to do with off-ramps. So in the United States, we always think that the constraining factor is domestic politics. So we need to let China save face by, like, you know, the United States provides some sort of rationale that lets China concede. But what I lay out in the book is that in most cases, the main concern of the people fighting has to do with what your enemy thinks, right? And domestic politics can often reflect that, in that you will hear debates in the Indian parliament of, like, we don't want to look weak in front of the Chinese because then China will exploit that. I don't really take that as domestic politics. I think it still falls in line with my argument as being mainly concerned about the enemy. So what that means is the United States actually, we cannot offer effective off-ramps to China. Because if China is concerned about looking weak in front of us, and we both know that this off-ramp is kind of BS, then it doesn't work. They still end up looking weak in front of us. So those types of off-ramps have to be offered by an outside party. And historically, China has actually turned to U.S. allies and partners to be the ones to offer those, and to put pressure on the United States to constrain the U.S. ability to escalate in certain ways. And so that might be an interesting role for Australia to play in the future as well.
But then doesn't the United States also go to those same allies and partners to try to look for a kind of mediator role as well? So rather than going to partners that might be influential for China, they're going to their own friends and allies. Is that...
Yeah, so I mentioned this, and I have an article version that goes much more into detail about China and contemporary conflicts. But I just think this is an interesting dynamic, that when China's upset with the United States, China goes to our allies and partners to pressure us. When we're upset with China, we also go to our allies and partners. But for China, it's not surprising that Japan sided with the United States. This doesn't make them rethink their strategy of, like, oh no, like, maybe we've gone too far this time. Like, of course Japan is siding with the United States, or of course Australia is siding with the United States. That's why I think, you know, in some cases, if the United States worked harder to go through partners that were closer to China, like if Russia all of a sudden was like, China, I think you've gone too far, or Cambodia was like, this is too much, then China, or Pakistan, right, then China would be like, maybe we have gone too far if the countries that usually side with us are saying that our current strategy is not working. So I think in many cases, you want to change Chinese expectations. We all know there's a lot of research on how people are bad at updating based on new information. But there are ways to do it. And one way is that the information has to be so different and so new from what you expect. It has to be shocking enough. And again, getting criticism from U.S. allies and partners usually doesn't really cause China to rethink the way forward.
Sure, but you would think that we don't have a lot of influence or purchasing power with Pakistan or with Cambodia. So it's not like Russia's suddenly going to listen to the United States' criticism of China.
Well, this is also a problem with how we define diplomacy, right? Because I was recently at a war game in the United States, and it was this obviously a very generalized scenario in which we had an ally that we wanted to side with us on an issue. And the biggest issue was the United States couldn't share all the intelligence to convince the ally that our interpretation of what had happened was correct. In my view, this was State Department, everyone was there, I was like, do we actually have to convince them? Or do we have to convince them that this is important enough to us that they should support us in it? You know, and the State Department's view was like, well, that's not how we do diplomacy. And I was like, well, maybe it should be. Because right now the United States standard is not only that countries sort of support what the U.S. does, but they also have to agree with us on everything, you know? It's like I have an older sister who would just do whatever she wanted to do, and I would try to convince my parents that they should let me do whatever I wanted them to do. And her strategy was much more effective. So I think in many cases, we don't need our allies and partners to say, yes, United States, we agree with your assessment on China. And yes, we agree with your, you know, methods, this, that, and the other. It's about, actually, what an Australian government official said to me the other day. Can we convince countries in the region that it is to their benefit for the United States to prevail in some of these areas of competition, even if they disagree with us? Right? That is a much lower standard. And I think that's what China does. They don't tell countries you have to agree with us across the board on all these specific things. It's like what they're actually asking of countries is a lot less than what the United States asks.
And what do you think, James? Are we being asked too much to agree with the United States' position on these things?
I think Ariana's got a very definite point on that, with the caveat that I think the Chinese would like you to agree on a lot more, and they'll have a go, but they'll pull back. I think all the evidence is that if you do push back on certain things, they will do it. Just to take up this point about using alternative means, I think also one of the issues for the United States is it wants to use its allies in certain circumstances to help demonstrate collective resolve. So using other countries as the mediators might well be the better way, because, yes, China might well pay more attention anyway, but it also doesn't send out conflicted signals, particularly, I think, for the really serious contingencies.
One of the things I was interested in your book, Ariana, was that in many of these conflicts there is an asymmetry between the powers that kind of results in the ways they interpret being brought to the negotiating table. Are we seeing that asymmetry in the kind of current United States-China competition? You know, we've already talked a little bit about capability, but the idea that that asymmetry is no longer there and that changes the calculus a little bit.
Yeah, so ironically, what I argue goes against kind of some of the conventional wisdom in political science, but I think it jives more with the empirical record, which is the more asymmetry you have in power, you can imagine that one side is much more concerned about looking weak because the repercussions of that can be existential. So it actually takes longer for negotiations to happen the more asymmetry in power you have. So when you have less asymmetry in power, it actually takes states not quite as long to get to the table because neither can really threaten the other to a great degree. So what this means in a conflict with China is it depends on China's perspective of who they're fighting, right? So if something happens between China and Taiwan, and in their mind in that period they're dealing with Taiwan, then there's a great asymmetry in their favor. If they think the United States is going to get involved and so their main audience for their actions is the United States, then they're going to be acting much more like it's a symmetric situation. Just a side note, though, we always think about diplomacy as a good thing. And it is a good thing, right? You need it to get to the end of a conflict. But the reason why weaker states are concerned about entering into negotiations is because you can use talks for a wide variety of reasons that is not to end the war. And what China likes to do, and I think what would be more likely in a Taiwan scenario, is they like to have some sort of fait accompli that then they say, okay, let's talk about this. It's less about negotiating the actual settlement and more about implementation of surrender. Right. And for the United States perspective, politically, it'll become very difficult for the United States to then come in and start using force against China if we're at a state of peace again. Right. And so if China can do it very quickly, and then when they offer diplomacy to Taiwan, it's not an olive branch. It's like, I want you to agree to surrender before the United States can get here. And if they do, then like the United States doesn't really have a leg to stand on to then come in and attack China, attack China in response. So diplomacy is, can also kind of go both ways.
And there's a very interesting example on a smaller scale, of course, in the Falklands conflict, when the British were very concerned that, in particular, the American mediation with Argentina would not create a situation whereby it did become a fait accompli and that Argentina could, in fact, consolidate and stay. And so Britain was having to manage that. And Mrs. Thatcher, I think, was particularly conscious of the point Oriana's making in her responses to Al Haig and others.
To your point, there is obviously this great asymmetry now between China and Taiwan, but the United States has increased its kind of confidence-building measures in the region. It's prioritizing crisis management while also increasing its military presence. So,
are we increasing our military presence? As far as I know, I was on a podcast the other day at CSIS, and they have this great question at the end where they say, name like one pop cultural reference that sums up the U.S. approach to great power competition. And so the one I use is a song by Beyonce called "The Best Thing I Never Had." Because I, as a China specialist, my whole career, I have heard that China is the pacing threat, that the United States has refocused on China. But I don't see it, right? I have been, at my first job at the Pentagon, my boss used to tell me, just go into rooms and bring up China. That is your only job because no one cares about it. No one's talking about it. Now people do care and they are talking about it, but it's at the highest levels of government and it is not trickling down to the majority of our military. As you know, at lower levels where I am of the military, I still spend all my time doing training on key leadership engagements with tribal leaders, right? Like we get no training about China, no training about great power competition. I'm in the middle of this course right now. I just spent all last weekend doing modules on Somalia, Venezuela, Afghanistan, no China anywhere. So in my view, it's like the problem right now is not U.S. commitment, though I know that is, I don't mean to make it worse. I know that's a big part of the discussion here, but you should not be worried about U.S. commitment. You should be worried about U.S. capabilities. Because in many cases, at least in the United States, we are committed. But when the balloon goes up, pretty soon we won't be able to do anything about it, regardless of how committed we are. So there definitely has to be, you know, rethinking of force posture. All of our force postures up in Northeast Asia, which is useless to us if we're fighting contingencies in the South China Sea. The equipment that we have is not useful. The ranges is not useful. China can outrange us in a lot of contingencies. So there definitely has to be a lot more thinking on the capability side. I'll leave the resolve and the U.S. commitment to our, you know, State Department and our people who are alliance managers. But the capability side is getting dire over time. And that's where I think the message needs to be, at least in the United States, because we think our military is the greatest, will always be the greatest. And so if you're outside of the military establishment, you're like, of course we would beat China all the time. The question is just, do we feel like it today? But if you're a military planner, that's not the way the picture looks over time.
No, I'd add a sub-point. I do wish the Europeans would understand that the pivot was meant to recognize that the United States could not manage both Russia and China. Europe, pull your finger out, look after Russia, and we will do China. And, of course, that hasn't happened. But, indeed, that needs to happen. So the Europeans need to look very hard at themselves.
I'll come to questions in a moment, but I also hope that you're not going to tell us that the Australian military aren't doing any practicing for China contingencies, because that was a slightly terrifying notion from Maria.
That's not something I could comment on, nor do I have any privileged access to that sort of thing.
So there's a difference between practicing at the higher military level and our whole military being focused on great power competition. And I would say we are still very much a counterinsurgency force to this day, which is very problematic. Our leaders at the lowest levels, it's like in Afghanistan, if someone was hurt, we could get them to a top-level hospital in a couple of hours. In an Asia contingency, we won't even go get you. So do our pilots know that? As far as I know, they don't, right? So people at the lower levels have a certain mentality about what these conflicts are going to look like that in no way jive with what a conflict with China would look like.
I think generally there is a greater understanding in the militaries of the West that there needs to be a return to a focus on high intensity and very sophisticated conflict. Is that partly about China? Yes, it probably is. But I'd also say, make a point, speaking as a former naval person that what we call overmatch is really good. So just because your opponent isn't really sophisticated doesn't mean you shouldn't go with the best you've got, because that means you're more likely to win with minimum casualties to your own people. So it isn't simply about, you know, major conflict, great power conflicts and potential involvement. It's about capability has uses across the spectrum.
I might go to the floor now. I could ask you to put up your hand and wait for one of my colleagues to bring you a microphone. And if you could identify yourself, please.
Thanks. I'm Ben Bland. I work on Southeast Asia here at the Lowy Institute. You've been talking a lot about conflict in the South China Sea, but given what you're saying about negotiations and fait accomplis, what we're seeing with Chinese bases and the code of conduct talks, I wonder if the bigger risk in the South China Sea isn't conflict between China and the Southeast Asian states, but actually surrender or some sort of soft deal where the Southeast Asian states agree, you know, terms with China that excludes other powers from the sea, whereas everyone's talking about conflict. To me, it almost looks like that's the bigger risk, but I wonder what your view is.
I mean, it completely, in my view, depends a lot on the U.S. response. You know, so some people would say Xi Jinping is overreached, you know, this is all going to come back and bite him, and I think it's too early to tell. It largely depends on whether or not the United States gets its act together and decides to push back. Right now, I think you're absolutely right. China is relying mainly on political, economic, and kind of course of diplomacy, gray zone military tools to establish this fait accompli. As long as they can do that successfully, they will avoid conflict. So the irony is, the more effective our policies are at countering those economic and political and legal measures, the higher the likelihood of conflict. So I have a Council of Foreign Relations memo coming out in about a month that basically lays out how I think the strategic environment in the region would have to change for China to resort to military force. And so it would have to be things like, you know, maybe a change of leadership in the Philippines and or Duterte, something happening so he no longer, it's no longer politically feasible for him to pursue this strategy. The code of conduct breaks down because Vietnam, as the new chairperson of ASEAN, you know, wants to put kind of a death knell in it or what have you. But there's definitely things, and part of that is going to depend, I think, on what U.S. strategy is in the region. To date, as far as I understand it, it's just like a lot of talk, but we aren't really doing much of anything to actually stop China from consolidating control. So if that's the case, you're right. I think the most likely scenario is, you know, China is able to establish this de facto control over the South China Sea without firing a shot because all the countries in the region basically respect and concede to that position. If the United States does get its act together and start pushing back, I think for now China would actually lower its standards and accept a degree of parity with the United States in the first island chain, and maybe accept less than de facto control over a lot of those waters, maybe not so the Paracels, but maybe the Spratlys. I think they would adjust their ambitions. Right now, they can get whatever they want with no cost. So, you know, why not give it a go until someone pushes back?
Yeah, I'd make a distinction, I think, between the military side and everything else. What I'd also say is a straw in the wind, which was quite encouraging, was the reaction of the ASEAN powers to the attempt by China to insert the clause about no exercises with non-regional powers from outside the region without the consent of the other signatories, and that got pushback from practically everybody in ASEAN, certainly anybody who has anything that floats.
And speaking of countries that, you know, might stand up to China in that way, I think Vietnam is kind of an interesting example. It will be the chair of ASEAN. Certainly in Australia and other kind of like-minded countries, we see Vietnam as being unique in that sense, but they also have this quite unique relationship with China. So, I mean, I do think that there is this risk of a deal possibly over the code of conduct or something else that does shut other people out. So I think Vietnam is somewhat...
And I say also in general, again, it's not my area of expertise because I focus on military issues, but it seems like our partnerships and alliances have to go beyond the military side. So, for example, you know, I know I've heard that Australian universities depend a lot on Chinese students, right? So maybe this is like a, you know, this is a lever that China can use. But imagine if China tried to punish Australia by not sending Chinese students, and then the United States didn't accept any students into the United States. China wouldn't use that lever anymore, right? But we don't actually think about multilateral responses to things that aren't military in orientation. So in many ways, I think the alliance is outdated in that, you know, NATO also needed to be renewed in some way. And I think we need to rethink, You know, not only, yes, of course, the United States comes to Australia's aid if Australia is attacked by China, but what are ways that we can work together to protect our sovereignty and our ability to be coerced or with political interference, such that there's some areas where Australia might have more sway than the United States and vice versa. China uses these measures because they work. So if we can get them to stop being so effective, then we can protect ourselves more against them, I think.
So another question just down back there.
Hi, Chloe White from Commonwealth Treasury. I was just wondering about the so-called trade war that's going on between the US and China. How do people in the military community see that in the broader picture, or do they even consider it at all? And what role do you think that it might be playing in China's perspective? And is it maybe some way that Trump's trying to bring China into line without some of these more traditional military encounters?
Lot there. So, you know, obviously I don't have access to every part of like the defense community, but in my experience, the trade war doesn't really play a big role. I would say that instead of the, I know we focus that on being a main area of tension, but I think the causal mechanism is actually the opposite, in that the security realm in the United States is where the tension began, and now it's spilling over into the economic realm. It's only recently that the business community and others have come on board with this view of China being a threat. We used to have much more, I think, what the situation is like in Australia, in which some people with more economic interests had a different vision of China than those with military interests. So I think that's the sort of the big thing right now is, you know, how does it actually change things? I think it changes China's view, because there was a debate in China for many years. And I'm going to say, it's always hard to sum up these debates, because their way of logic is a bit different than ours. But their concern, their view is that how countries respond to them has nothing to do with Chinese behavior, right? It has only to do with the structural differences in power. So the United States is always going to feel threatened because of those because the asymmetry is reducing. Japan is going to feel threatened because now China's has a bigger economy than Japan's. So their behavior is not what determines threat perceptions. It is power asymmetries. So in China, they were having this debate about, is it true that if they rose peacefully, meaning they did not directly use kinetic military force, the United States would concede its position to China? And there was a debate about it, but I think now China, partially because of U.S. policy, the trade war, they see these as examples of like last-ditch efforts of the established hegemon to hold on to its position no matter what and not accept a graceful decline. So this is just sort of exacerbating the view in Beijing of like, someday the United States might attack China for no reason, nothing that China did, but just a kind of preventive way to maintain U.S. position. So I think they are becoming much more concerned about the United States trying to thwart their rise than they were before.
Tim Coyle, the Department of Defense. Let's shift our focus to the Southwest Pacific, and particularly the Australian step up. Concern, obviously, there is China's influence through the Belt and Road Initiative, soft power primarily, but also from the military sense, ports being converted possibly in the future to accept naval or constabulary type vessels. So the question is, with the Australian step up, we need more diplomacy, and we also need an answer from the point of view of not necessarily hard military power, but perhaps we need to adopt some of the Chinese very successful grey zone activities using constabulary vessels, coast guards, etc., like that from our own side. Your views, please.
One of the points I would make about the Chinese use of Coast Guard vessels is actually discredited them quite significantly. White hulls are no longer viewed in quite the same way as they were, say, 10 years ago. They are seen in certain circumstances as coercive use of state force. So it's not quite as clean a cut as it used to be. What I would say is that I think that Australia does need to be doing as much in the Pacific as it can. I think the word balance is probably a better way to talk about it. China will be there as well. I mean, China is already there. It's commercially there. It's extensive. And I suppose what Australia should be trying to do is to be as helpful as possible and as effective as possible. For instance, if you talk to some of the Pacific countries, they are quite cynical about the amount of Australian aid money that's actually spent on Australian assurance that the aid money is being spent in a certain way to meet Australian standards. Now, not to say that we shouldn't be doing that to some extent, but, you know, there are costs of doing it the Australian way, which we've got to be careful not always to impose. But I do think we need to be there. What I'd also say is I would be, if China established a permanent naval military base in the Southwest Pacific, we're in a completely new space. And it's complete would be reflect a completely different way of China approaching its military and naval problems. So I'd be interested to see, even though if you look at the latest white paper, it does talk about capabilities of establishing foreign bases, and they now have one in Djibouti, which is very much effectively next to a major airfield, and it's a forward operating base for services protected evacuation. But we'd be in a new space. And I believe that China's motives in the Southwest Pacific are fundamentally commercial and economic and tied up with a whole range of things. And I think they need to be met by an effective Australian effort. I hate the expression whole of government. I think it's become discredited, and it's much more than government. An effective Australian effort to be doing the right thing about Pacific development in every sense of the word. And that's not just military, but it does, you know, and I've been involved in the South Pacific fisheries, does involve a strong maritime security element, but involves so much more than that, and so much more than just government.
Hi, thank you very much. A really interesting discussion. I'm Meriden Vrile. I'm a non-resident fellow here at Lowy and the Director of Geopolitics and Tax at KPMG. And I just wanted, perhaps it's timely to go right back to the sort of question of this panel. Avoiding war, how states negotiate. And Ariane, I wonder if I could just get a sense of how you think China negotiates and what the similarities and differences might be with how we, inverted commas, negotiate and how we, inverted commas, can negotiate effectively with China to get the outcomes that we might want.
Yeah, so I think peacetime negotiations are very different than wartime negotiations. In a lot of cases, some of the problems, at least I see between China and the United States, is we're actually quite similar. We both have very strong narratives of exceptionalism, of which, you know, our historic rightful place is to be number one. We think historic, you know, just like countries will be like, you know, the U.S. decline is inevitable. That is not how we feel about it in the United States, right? Historic trends do not apply to us, right? We will be number one forever. People say the Chinese economy can't continue to grow at this rate. You know, the Chinese also feel like that was the experience of other developing countries. It doesn't apply to us either. So a lot of times I think, at least when the United States and China interact with each other, the big issues were actually so similar. We look at, power in very different ways, but the United States was also revisionist after World War II in setting up international institutions, being very entrepreneurial in that. When you actually get into a room about negotiations, I mean, one of the big things I think has shifted in Washington is people have come to their understanding about two things about negotiating with China. One, cooperating on lower level issues does not build goodwill and make it easier for us to reach agreements on other issues. There was this view a lot during the Obama administration that, like, okay, we can work on this and then we get to know each other and then we can talk about the South China Sea. But China doesn't actually do issue linkages in that way. And they also, you know, reset once they're given a concession. You know, so it's like, okay, we did this for you on this issue area, so you should do this for us. And they're like, well, no, we reset after that, right? Now we start from a new baseline. So I think there's, whether it's people on the left or on the right, there's a general understanding or view right now that kind of cooperating and so negotiating in the peacetime space doesn't really get us anywhere with China. We can have all the exchanges we want, but in the end, it's not going to shape how they think about their interests. You know, we used to think that engagement and dialogue, we could convince China to see the world differently. More importantly, I don't think many people realize this explicitly, but we thought that by engaging with us, China would realize they were better off with the United States as number one. And many people were shocked to find that China, and I remember it was like, you know, 15 years of being like, well, this doesn't make any sense to me. As like, you know, because as someone who's like rising career-wise, I get that kind of advice all the time of like, just wait your turn. It'll be like better off if we make all this. And I'm thinking, no, I'd like to be the one in charge, right? So I think for China, that makes a lot of sense. So right now, there's not a lot of room for engagement in that, sure, we can do it, maybe, so at least we can say we tried. So if anything, you know, happens, the United States is in a more legitimate position when we end up having to escalate things. But I think there's a viewpoint that, you know, it doesn't really get you anywhere. What gets you somewhere is by pushing back. And this happens with the trade war, too. When I talk to the Chinese, they would say, you know, but now we're conceding all these things. And I'm like, yeah, and the lesson we're learning, we've asked you nicely for so long and you gave us nothing. Now we'd be difficult, you know, now that we're difficult, all of a sudden you care. Now that we're about to invade North Korea, all of a sudden you care. Now that we have this trade war, all of a sudden you care. So the lesson we're learning is you have to be difficult with China or else they won't make any changes to their policies.
I will say that when you mentioned earlier that that China doesn't necessarily think other countries respond to it because of its behavior, but actually because of power structures, it did strike some parallels for me with the way we feel about the United States sometimes. So, you know, I'm not surprised by that analysis. But I've learned a lot from you both today. Thank you all so much for coming to the last event of the year at the Lowy Institute. We're looking forward to seeing all of you in 2020, which will be a tumultuous year with elections in Taiwan, Myanmar, the United States, and all of those avenues of conflict and instability will be probably just as scary. But for now, thank you all so much for coming. Please join me in thanking our panel.